Back, just to give a little history for those of you not familiar, back about 1996, but it's come up multiple times, EPA has mandated that the states develop numeric criteria for nutrients. Currently, most of our nutrient-related criteria are all narrative. And EPA's justification was they didn't think the narrative standards were doing an adequate job of protecting the nation's waters from eutrophication. They required each state to develop a nutrient work plan at that time, too. TCEQ had one. They are in the process now of revising their existing work plan for nutrients. In that, in June 2010, they adopted standards for chlorophyll A for 75 reservoirs. Most of the major reservoirs in Nebraska were subject to that. However, those are still under EPA review and not currently incorporated into the state standards yet. It's something that they're going to assess against. In the work plan, it does say streams are in progress, but probably not going to have much recommended solid on streams till the 2016-2017 time frame. So they're working on revising the work plan. And so for this review period and standards, there aren't going to be any new nutrient criteria for waste. So a little bit of a breather till 2016-2017 time frame. But for the world of water and wastewater that is going to have to probably make, in some cases, some major modifications, waiting till the day that we have those standards may not be prudent. So one thing TCEQ has done, they have a draft 2012 implementation plan on how they will take those nutrient standards and then apply them to the world of wastewater permitting. And that is available on their website. It's still draft, but it gives a pretty good idea of how TCEQ is going to take that stream standard and translate it into what your effluent limit is going to be on your wastewater plant. Defines the procedures, and it has procedures right now based on reservoir and or surface water, depending on where you discharge to. The applicability in there is any new or expanding domestic discharge will be evaluated for phosphorus and potentially total nitrogen, depending on the location where you're discharging to, and it will receive a limit if warranted. It's not kind of a blanket like some of the bacteria where everybody's getting a limit. This one, it will be dependent on the conditions of where you discharge. And then industrial discharges, it's mainly going to determine on their process, what they're doing at their facilities, if they have potentially contributing high loads of nutrients. It has kind of a two-step assessment phase in the implementation plan. Initial one kind of goes through, if you meet these general requirements, then you go to the more intense assessment phase. And then that more intense comprehensive screening is really intense. It's got multiple steps. It's very detailed. But I think it'll be very good because it really does seem to take a lot of different stream conditions into play and try to determine the potential for the nutrients in a wastewater discharge to have a negative impact on that stream. It is pretty detailed. I'm not sure why the permit writers did that to themselves because it's going to be a lot of work on their part, but I think it'll be good overall. The general procedures are generally focusing, the IP plan says, on total phosphorus, but they can, depending on conditions, look at nitrogen too. If you discharge into the main body of a reservoir or near the reservoir upstream, not they had distances based on the size of the reservoir and the flows in there, anything over 1 mg/d is going to automatically go to that second level of review. If you're discharging to a shallow or restricted cove of a reservoir and your discharge is greater than 0.25 mg/d, you're automatically going to go to that intense level of review. The watershed rules or other specific requirements may automatically kick you into it too. So if you're on the 303D list for nutrients, if you have a TMDL for some sort of nutrient-related thing, Edwards Aquifer rules, we don't have anyone from Lake Travis, but Lake Travis Watershed has, well, they actually have a no-discharge rule, but things like that would automatically kick you to that next level of assessment. And smaller discharges, less than 0.25, they're not off the hook. They don't automatically get it, but depending on where they discharge to, they may or may not have to go through the intense review process too. The general procedure for streams, very similar to that for reservoirs, except that if your plan is 0.25 MGD or greater, and you're going into a perennial, shallow, clear, rocky bottom stream, which is basically the perfect storm for vegetative growth, you're going to automatically get kicked down to that more intense review, or long, shallow, clear streams with perennial impoundments, and then everything else is the same. The typical limits that they put that they're looking at in here range from 1 to 0.5 milligrams per liter. From what I can read, that seems to be a fairly reasonable amount. If those stay, there's question on whether the EPA will be accepting of those or not. Florida has some levels significantly lower than that. With what we can find and what we've looked at, there are available technologies capable of getting us to that limit. Once you start going below 0.5 towards the 0.1s, it starts to get a little more questionable whether you can get there. And this isn't cheap to take a wastewater plant to here. It's about 10 times more to go to 0.1. So the cost benefit of those lower, ultra low standards and whether it's realistic to treat to them is still a question. But 0.5, I think they've set some good limits that hopefully will be protected but are also feasible for facilities to hit. Determining what it means, if you're a plant operator, it's a plant by plant situation. It's going to be highly variable. Also, whether you're looking a new plant or trying to retrofit an old facility can determine it. I recommend, in this process we're going through right now, is downloading that IP plan and work through the state's calculations on their review just to kind of get an idea of where you sit, so you know if you're looking reasonably, should be expecting to get one of these phosphorus limits. Also, what it'll mean depends on your current type of treatment. Nitrification, which is the ammonia removal process, almost everybody in the state does that. Depending on the facility, whether they can nitrify and go the next step and remove nitrates, that will help on some of it, but it doesn't necessarily solve all the problem if you're denitrifying. And then the level of removal needed is going to be an issue too, so probably a good idea to try to determine what your total phosphorus loading is, so you know going in before you start looking at options to remove phosphorus. When will the criteria impact the actual permits? Not real sure. It's kind of all over the place from what I can see. We have permits now in our basin that already have nutrient limits in it. We have permits that require monitoring of nutrients and reporting of the nutrients. I would expect probably at least in the Williamson County area, some of those areas where they are the crystal clear, rocky bottom, shallow streams, I would not be surprised if during this round of permitting we start to see more nutrient limits or monitoring requirements pop up. But we don't have a real indication yet. I've always heard, well, we can't put a nutrient limit in until we have a nutrient standard to base it off of, but we're already starting to see nutrient limits. So I think there's been some shift in their thinking on that over the last couple rounds of permitting. And then don't have a real good indication on, once those standards are there and they start putting them into permits, how quickly do they expect that plant to be able to meet that limit? Because you just can't put a limit in and say, okay, your conventional treatment plant has to meet this tomorrow. It's not physically possible. What we have seen in a few of the plants, one plant, but it was designed from the beginning to do advanced nutrient removal, but they had 3 years to get up to that limit and be able to treat water to that limit. I don't know what they'll do with a plant that has to be retrofitted. Other things to consider if you're operating existing plants: your capacity restraints, property restraints. You'll see this one's excellent. This facility has a parking lot there, highway right here, some sort of building right there. If they have to expand or do new construction to treat nutrients, they can't buy that little piece of property. I don't know what they're going to do. And then energy costs. A lot of the nutrient removal require additional energy, and some of them a whole lot more energy than what a conventional plant operation needs. And then your operation cost, automated systems for feeding your chemicals. It's going to take more staff time. Your staff's going to have to work at a higher level than they've been used to, depending on how your plant operates. Biological removal, like I said, most current facilities in the state have to remove ammonia. Some of them also already use this process to remove nitrate. Very few are designed to remove phosphorus. I know of one in our entire basin that's designed to remove phosphorus, and it's the one I talked about. It was just built in the last 10 years and was designed to do full nutrient removal. If you can use BNR to do your nutrient removal, it does appear to be the most cost-effective solution if it'll get you to the permit limits you need. Nitrogen through BNR is really good unless for some reason you get a really tight nitrogen limit and it has no removal mechanism for your soluble organic nitrogen. It can work through your particulate organics, your ammonias, your nitrates, your nitrites. It does real good at removing those. Should be okay depending on standards unless you start looking at overload levels. Phosphorus, to get most TP standards, it appears the industry in general seems to think you need to remove both your particulate and your solubles. You can use BNR to do that. However, more than likely, you're going to have to construct additional contact chambers and aeration basins to get yourself there because the denitrification process, there's some competing biological reactions going on there that almost need their own place to be occurring. So that would be the one problem, is if you don't have room, BNR may not be an option. You can also get phosphorus removal through chemical precipitation, either using aluminum and iron coagulants or lime. It's pretty pricey, and also it, not only is the chemicals itself pricey to buy, but also it increases your sludge disposal rates because you're A, making more sludge and making nastier sludge. For ultra low levels, what we found may require a combination. It's probably BNR is not going to get you to the ultra low level by itself. You're going to have to do some combination, either chemical, additional filtration units, and in some places, advanced treatment. Looked at Florida, where they do have some ultra low levels, even I think below 0.1, and they were looking at having to go through a conventional BNR treatment process and then use a ultrafiltration reverse osmosis to hit that level. The energy cost, the disposal issues created by that, everything else, I don't know how they're going to do it without bankrupting their utilities, but that's the levels that got set in Florida.
Are these going to get tied into the stormwater permit?
I have no idea. I would guess probably so, because I don't think just controlling point sources is going to alleviate the nutrient problems out of the stream. There's going to have to be something for non-point source. How quickly? I have no idea. Probably they'll get through this process easier because it's a low-hanging fruit, easy to deal with. But then I can't imagine not having to do something to go after non-point sources also. New facilities, if you have that luxury and the budget availability to do it, that's probably the easiest way to go. Design it to hit the limits and for the loadings you've got from the beginning. Give you a lot of flexibility. But that's probably not realistic for 99% of the municipalities and utility operators out there. So retrofit is probably what you're going to have to be looking at. So you need to start considering your aeration base size and configuration that you have. How much for that first slide, how much TP do you need to remove, your clarifier capacities, your sludge processing units, and the skills of your operators. Cost, the new plant costs are really based on the size and influent quality you're coming in. Retrofit's gonna vary tremendously based on what you already have and what you need to get to. Two trends you see though, the larger the facility, the more water it's treating, the more cost effective it is to do it. And the smaller your limit, the more expensive it's going to be. The big change that these nutrient standards are going to cause is traditionally wastewater's been able to, they have to increase their capacity based on their population size. So as their population grows, they get their plants built or build new plants, but there's new people to spread that cost out again. Here, there's no new people to spread the cost out again, so these pretty intense high-dollar processes, your existing customer base is going to have to bear the brunt of that and feel the load versus, you know, maybe everyone sees a quarter and in bill increase, maybe several dollars a bill increase, and there's no new people to spread the cost out from. So that's going to probably not go down so well with customers of different utilities. At least I know our customers never like it when we raise our bill. I did some research. Some other states are a little further ahead of us in the process and have done some really intense economic studies. So I tried to just put some summaries of what they've done. Maryland and Connecticut, this was a study, and it averaged it to treat and remove phosphorus and do BNR upgrades to a facility that doesn't have it can range anywhere from $7,000 per million gallon a day generated to 588. You can really see the cost savings you get by your volume. The bigger the facility, the cost rate goes down. Montana did a study looking at hitting different limits and what it's going to cost there. Again, you can see the bigger plants, much more cost effective in the long run, but your O&M goes up. But when you crank those limits down, it almost triples the rates of the O&M and the capital construction. So determining how much you're going to have to spend is going to be key on what your limit's going to be. And then this was one from the Bosque. This is not what's actually being implemented, but it was a study done back, I think, 04-06 time frame on the Bosque and what it would cost. And they went out to the point of calculating percent increases on the monthly residential bills if each individual facility upgraded. I don't know many of us in this room would probably be thrilled to see 168% increase in our sewer bill.
And you know, and that's according to the population, looks like.
Yeah. The more people, yeah, Stephenville's the biggest city. Iredell's probably the smallest on that list.
It's tiny.
And so, and you can see how much more expensive it is at these lower flows than the big ones. What that's going to do, there are some other things. It's probably going to require some creativity in the long run for different ways, or maybe some different ways of thinking about treatments. And in this watershed, they actually did that. When they looked at this,
$40 a month.
They went through and decided they could get the loading reduction from the world of wastewater that they needed if Stephenville and Clifton upgraded their facilities. So these four smaller towns got off the hook, but I believe, if I remember right, in Penny Craig's room, I think they committed or contributed financially to the upgrades at the others. But may have to start looking at things from a watershed size rate to make this cost effective, because there's probably no way that Iredell could handle that. And honestly, the poor folks of Iredell, I know I'm laughing at a $40 bill because I love it, but they couldn't afford that. That's just their what sewer bill. That's not their drinking water. That's not their waste removal. That's just going to be their sewer
bill. It's very tiny. It's very small.
Yeah, so that's a question I have asked EPA multiple times. I've asked the TCEQ, which TCEQ's just having what EPA is doing to them, is what happens when the permit comes out and Iredell has a limit it can't meet? It can't afford to do the upgrades. It doesn't have the population to spread the cost out. What are you going to do? Are you going to put them in enforcement, charge them another $100,000 they don't have? Or are you going to go in one day and flip the switch on the wastewater plant and turn it off when they can't meet it? There's a lot of smaller towns in our basin that are going to be in that situation.
Pack them all up and move them to the big city.
And we get no answer out of them. I don't think there's any. There's not, you know, federal funds and grants. Clean Water State Revolving Fund is getting less and less and less from the federal government to help with upgrades and things like that. So it's going to be a real interesting issue once we start getting these plants and plants start failing to meet those standards.
They're not looking at it as a total segment contribution among all contributors, just a function of Iredell could contribute.
They're looking at individual permits. So
but I don't know. But as a function of permitting, would they?
I don't know.
Seems
how
to me that might be a better
way. I don't know if they've gotten their head around it enough to know at the state level, and I don't think EPA cares.
Are they letting any of the plants do consolidation of effluent to have a final single treatment plant for new nutrients and phosphorus, that kind of approach where they can discharge based on nutrients alone?
And traditionally, what I've seen TCEQ do is they'll put the limit in the plant or in the permit, and then how you get there is usually up to you. So if you can work, either if you have multiple smaller facilities in yours and you consolidate it at one and hit it, or I know we do have one group we operate for, and they do have multiple small facilities, but one phosphorus limit for all five facilities. And as long as the total is less than that, they're okay. So they have kind of taken kind of the same approach. We're going to upgrade one, make it super clean, and let the others alone, but by doing the upgrades on the one, they're getting below their phosphorus levels. It's probably going to take a lot of campaigning on local. I would guess, you know, this coalition probably have to go campaign pretty hard. Hey, overall, we're hitting it, and make that very argument you did. But
and what kind of time frame are we looking at?
That's the question. We're seeing phosphorus limits and nitrate limits and total nitrogen limits actually popped up in several plants in the basin already.
So it just depends on when their permits come up for renewal.
Depends when their permits come up for renewal. Right now, it's usually on a basin-wide schedule, and we're in our period. So whether permitting jumps forward and starts doing that, I don't think they'll do it basin-wide just because the surface water standard isn't in place yet. But I know where we've seen it is mostly, we've seen a lot of it in Williamson County, but that's also where we have the clear, shallow, rocky water bodies. I don't know if we'll see them try to put something on the Bosque, or since there's already so much work being done, if they'll get a pass this time. I really wouldn't anticipate it basin-wide to even be considered until the next round of permitting, just because those surface standards aren't in place, aren't approved by EPA yet. And watching what's going on in some of the other states and the lawsuits that have gone back and forth and back and forth, I don't know when we would have something the TCEQ could actually enforce on as far as the surface water standard. Hopefully, I know they're watching all those other activities very closely, and we'll avoid the pitfalls that Florida fell into and some of the other states have fallen into, but the EPA seems to be moving the target a whole lot too. Some of the other strategies you may consider, and we're seeing this a lot up in the Metroplex, is treatment wetlands. Running, using your conventional system, but before it either goes back to the creek or river, running it through a wetland to remove the nutrients that way. Pretty cost effective, is a little maintenance intensive because you've got to maintain the wetlands, but it works. This is one the North Texas Municipal Water District has on the southeast side of Dallas. You see Dallas in the background. It's really neat. It just takes a lot of effort and time to do that, but they are cleaning it to the point they're putting it, pumping it back uphill, putting it in the chain, and kind of creating a reusable loop for the Dallas area using it. Watershed strategies, just like we talked, cities are probably, small towns are going to have to band together and probably fight this or combine together. One guy does all the upgrades, the other help pay for it. Or start moving, we have seen some of this in Williamson County, to a reuse and no discharge style facility. Round Rock is on a, it's starting a massive reuse project. Taking most of their, I think their facility is 20 MGD facility, they're diverting most of it for beneficial reuse now versus discharging it to Russian Creek. And that's great until we get to the point we start grinding up streams.
Yeah, there goes the load.
And Big Spring.
And you're just putting them back to the original. In our case, Carter Creek was an intermittent stream, and we're being, you know, permitted, etc., on a, you know,
perennial stream.
So yeah. we're taking a bite because we're discharging Bryan College Station at a constant rate, so we have a perennial stream there. So we'll just take it back to its natural environment.
There you go.
And we dry it up.
How long?
Well, and there's truth to that.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, how long is that? How long has the discharge been going into the creek, though?
Probably since around 1950-ish.
Right, so at what point is it? You've changed it, but at some point after so many years, it's...
And then you look at reuse, and you start looking at groundwater and in the drought, and we'll be ours is all groundwater based, so we're already looking at direct potable reuse. There's, you know, funding some research, et cetera, and we've got, you know, we're, I don't know, somewhere down the road we'll probably be using a large percentage of ours. I may be tired by then, but, you know, it's in the works. So you kind of go through those cycles.
Yeah, that's the next big question, I think.
Yeah, there's a lot of cities looking at that.
Well, and then we were just talking about this at our program meeting, and then we read an article in the paper about the pharmaceuticals that aren't being taken out of the water, and then when you start reusing it and you're putting it into a lake or a res.
Yeah, we're hooking up with Baylor to do a little wetland study off the treatment plant for an uptake of it.
Yeah.
There's ways, you know, oxidation, et cetera, when you start looking at it, it draws, it runs the cost, but when you can't get the water, this goes back to the $40 treatment of wastewater. Okay, I can kind of finagle through that, but if I can't drink, what's the cost of 1,000 gallons of water for me to drink? So there's a lot of that kind of stuff going on.
I think there are some massive legal battles coming in the world of water in the future.
Yes. It's money to be made by lawyers.
That was it. Oh, I did put, it'll be on our webpage, but I put the references in case you wanted to go find some of those where I found the cost information if you wanted to get those documents and read them yourselves. The Montana one seemed to be extremely detailed. They looked even at different types of treatment that I am not a skilled enough operator to try to explain here and costed it out. That one I thought was really good. I'm really looking at practical cost of what it's going to take. I realize Montana is very different from us, but they seem to have the most detailed cost study. I think that's it, unless there's other questions.
I assume we all have presentations on the site.
Next week.
Thank you.
I'm just wondering, as far as licensing on operators, that's going to drive.
I don't know if
you got higher licenses.
It may. I don't know how that'll. I don't know if anyone's even thought to ask that question.
Nobody's thought that way.
Yeah. I mean, it very well may. I know, at least on the drinking water side of things, when we operated the reverse osmosis facility and the EDR facility at SWATS, it took a whole separate set of skills for those guys to run that with the conventional, which all they had was honestly the conventional drinking water licenses, but getting their drinking water license, they weren't equipped to run that plant without having to seek outside training and expertise for them. So
I think you're going to see another round. Back was in the early 90s when TCEQ required licenses for wastewater and water, and you saw a lot of the, I say a lot, quite a few of the individuals who'd been in the industry for years and didn't have a high school diploma, they went ahead and dropped out or retired or whatever. I think you're going to see the same thing happen. And those that have been there for 20 years or 25 and can retire with a seat and say, well, I don't want to deal with that. You'll see a whole new skill set, like you're saying, walk in. And the cost is going to go up. So you're going to have to pay for it.
Well, I know we've heard that from a lot of our chief operators at the different plants in long term. I said the high school kids they're getting, A, no one wants to do it because it's not cool and it's not flashy. But even when they do get it, so half of them don't have the base core math skills they need to do it with. And especially if you're in a plant that's more difficult and requires more tending.
We started, I don't know, maybe 8-9 years ago, actually giving a basic math test. Because we found that the high school students that we were getting couldn't pass the supposed eighth grade level D test TCEQ has. And so we started just to call them out. And here's 10 questions, answer them. And we pick up their cell phones and everything else with a calculator on it. And if they can't do that, then we didn't even interview them. And I'm really surprised on my environmental techs. I haven't hired a couple A&M juniors because they could not do basic math without a calculator or, you know. So it's scary what you got out there.
There's an A&M joke in there.
It's a statement of our whole system right now is what it is.
Well, we do that for our lab techs and it makes you feel better. I had one right on there. I know how to do math instead of actually proving she can do the math. She didn't get the job.
Wow.
How hard is it to get them off cell phones, iPads, you know, et cetera? If we don't start somewhere down the road, confiscating those at the door or putting them in the locker.
But honestly, when you're in the, you do have a calculator for you.
Yeah. You do, but you have to have a common knowledge
of how to do it.
If I punch my numbers in, is it a multiple of 10 of that? Is it, you know, where am I at? Is this a reasonable number? And if they can't do basic math or change a fraction to a decimal, then they really can't, you know, understand did they punch it in the calculator right or not. Is that number, am I going to put 100 pounds of that in there or 1 pound of that in there? So you really have to have one where they can at least understand that much. We have one of our superintendents when TCQ really started up. He spent months giving classes the last hour of work on Fridays just to get the workforce to the point where they could understand the math. It's a real sad commentary on where we're at.
Well, and I think regardless going forward, even with some of the older ones, we're going to see, or we have seen in the past, a lot of complacency. Everything's running along okay, so people get a little slack at checking their numbers and double-checking stuff and making sure things are going right, and that's not going to be an option anymore. As long as it's coming out, your bacterias are good, your solids and BODs are good, it's doing this nutrient removal is going to take a lot more manipulation in the facilities that we have require constant. You just can't look at it. You've got to be able to identify a trend and see small trends. Okay, my ammonia is starting to creep up. Something's going wrong. I got to get that back under control. So it's going to take a whole probably shake up in the world of wastewater treatment too and operations. I think we're done unless there's any more questions.
I think y'all did a great job.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tiffany, especially. Thank you to the Walker. Yeah, these presentations will be up on the website.
You have some.